They're called sheltered workplaces, environments where people with disabilities can get pre-vocational training and work with the ultimate goal of transitioning into the workplace. But opinions over these sheltered workplaces vary considerably. While some advocates for people with more severe disabilities argue sheltered work is a necessary way for people who couldn't find work in more traditional competitive settings to get fulfillment and modest pay, other advocates for people with disabilities claim too many people are being funneled into these sheltered workplaces, and some sheltered workplaces may even be taking advantage of people with disabilities in order to get cheap labor. Well, during this year, there have been some moves to both eliminate sheltered workplaces and to continue them with some reforms. It's a complicated and very delicate issue, and we'll talk about it this hour on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and I'm joined in studio by three men who are front and center on disability issues in Western Wisconsin. First, I'd like to welcome Stacy Wigfield. Stacy is the president of REACH, that's Regional Enterprises for Adults and Children. Stacy Wigfield, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Our pleasure. Next, I'd like to welcome Tim Sheehan. Tim is the executive director for the Center for Independent Living of Western Wisconsin. Tim Sheehan, thank you for joining us as well.
Nice to be back.
Good to have you back. And finally, I'd like to welcome Mort Cypress. He is a familiar voice and familiar mention, at least, on the West Side here, as he normally helps us with on-air production. But today, he is in an advocacy role. Mort is a concerned parent of a child with cognitive disabilities, and he is the chair of an advocacy group called the A-Team. Mort Cypress, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here, Rich.
Good to have you. And listeners, we'd like to hear from you, too. Give us a call at 1-800-228-5615 if you've got any questions or comments about sheltered workplaces. If you or a child or a family member use these sheltered workplaces, let us know what your thoughts are. And if you've got concern about these type of work environments, let us know, too. 800-228-5615. So I thought we'd start with Stacy, and first, I think we should get some definitions out there, because prior to my doing some research for this program, I did not know very much about it, and I assume that holds true for some of the listeners. So, sheltered workplace, what does that mean, and does REACH have any of them?
Yeah, sheltered work is kind of an old term. We like to use the term facility-based employment or community rehabilitation programs. It's just one of the many ways that we've evolved over the years to where we're at now. In the old days, where the word sheltered work came from was as opposed to being competitive employment, where those of us without disabilities would actually compete for the same job, and may the person with the best skills and the fastest work rate win, and they get the job. In the sheltered employment area, it was that we would take people with disabilities with perhaps lesser skills at that moment in their lives, and we'd try to enhance their skills, increase their productivity, but they wouldn't get fired because of their lack of productivity or because of their lack of soft skills, which are the social skills on the work floor. We've evolved over time to be the number one providers of community-based employment, where we take people with disabilities and place them into competitive jobs within the community. So at the same time, we can offer employment to those that don't have those work skills yet that would get them into a job in the community and allow them to keep that job where they're competing with people without disabilities. So it's a place really where people can go at least initially to learn some work skills. However, if you function at a level where you are likely to never develop the work skills to compete at a job at minimum or above wage, then there's a place for you to work versus not work and stay home and do little or nothing. So we've evolved over the years, and have REACH, for example, is way more than that. We have a Birth to Three program. We have fully inclusive child care. And as mm-hmm. I mentioned, we do have a program that places people with disabilities into jobs in the community. So we do a lot of things that we think are really cutting edge.
How long has REACH been around?
REACH, coincidentally, is celebrating its 50th year right now. And to not to jump ahead, but It's kind of interesting to us that after having been around 50 years and having been put together by parents and guardians of those people who weren't getting served at all, that there is some talk at the federal level and actually all across the country by some advocates that we would turn back the clock to prior to the 50 years ago that REACH has been in existence. So that's why we're watching it very closely.
All right. Now, Tim Sheehan, the Center for Independent Living in Western Wisconsin, you place folks with disabilities into the community as well. How does your program differ from REACH as far as do you have any sheltered work type of environments?
Yeah. Centers for Independent Living are at our core disability rights organizations.
Okay. You
know, we operate on a philosophy that individuals with disabilities have a right, as in a civil right, to full participation in all aspects of society. The services we provide to any person, any disability, any age, regardless of income. So, you know, we come at the entire issue about community integration, about where people want to live and who they want to live with, the types of activities they want to engage in the community from an individual point of view. You know, I think Stacy's right about when he talks about the evolution of the model. From a disability rights point of view, that evolution hasn't been broad enough or quick enough. You know, beyond whatever policy implications there might be to resolve these issues going forward, our bottom line from advocates like myself is we really come at this from a moral point of view first, that individuals, especially young individuals with significant disabilities, ought to have the opportunity to explore the wholeness of their life before they end up in a place where they're working alongside other people with disabilities at a wage that is not competitive in the community. So some type of evolution of the business model, some type of active choice prior to placement, we think would be a place to start policy-wise, and then truly working hard with our friends and partners in the community-based rehab programs to look back at the folks who were there and say, what is that progress? Is today the day? Is this the week? Is this the month that we can work cooperatively together to begin to develop a plan to transition that person from that enclave environment into the community with the level of supports, frankly, that are required for so many folks, which really is an evolutionary step backwards when we rolled away from the types of on-the-job supports that we used to be able to do under the old supported employment model. We need to get back to some of that.
And Mort, I'm going to ask you, when we're talking about these sheltered workplaces and the issue is it's much broader than just sheltered versus non-sheltered workplaces, I understand that. But for the sake of this discussion, the people who benefit most from a sheltered versus a non-sheltered situation?
It depends on the individual and what that individual is capable of. The more severely disabled, and especially cognitively disabled people, may not be able to operate at all in a competitive environment. My daughter is among those. She's 40 years old. She operates at roughly the five-year-old level. She's just not able to keep up with the kind of productivity that we would expect for even a minimum wage. But she does at least get some work experience through the efforts over at REACH. She is at REACH and has been since she was 21 years old. Before that, she was the school system had the responsibility for her program. What REACH does for her and other agencies similar to that around the state and around the nation is they combine developmental work with a real type of job that she can deal with. No one is expecting her to produce at a competitive level, but she at least gets some real work experience. She's not isolated from the community. These workshops involve the people in the community as well. And Judy gets a couple of hours a week through the supported employment program, for example, where she can do some shredding, which is a fairly low skill kind of job, but mm-hmm. nobody's going to do shredding 8 hours a day. So she gets some of that experience, but also in the sheltered workshop, there's staff who are working closely with these individuals, helping them to stay on task, and making sure that whatever productive level is possible is achieved. So that it's not a matter of being isolated. There are other people there, and at the same time, you have your peers there. Judy is not going to go out and go to a dance with people, with regular people, and socialize with them. She can be very withdrawn when she is with people who are far more advanced than she is. She's able to go to an environment where her peers are there, her friends are there, capable staff is there. It's a very healthy type of operation for her. And I fear that that's what's going to be eliminated, and that will be a step backwards.
Well, we'll get into more of those details in just a bit. I want to remind the listeners that we're talking about sheltered workplaces and work environments for people with disabilities. There's a big debate, and has been for a while, over what the right model is, whether it be a sheltered, closed environment or moving people into the workplace, the traditional workplace, whether it be minimum wage or higher. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. The number again, 1-800-228-5615. If you've got any questions or comments or any stories to share, we've got wide open phone lines. You can also leave a message on our Westside Facebook page. So I want to kind of get into, where did this idea start, the idea of sheltered work? And from what I was researching, it goes way back, doesn't it, Stacy?
Yeah, it goes back about that 50 and 60 years. And
like 1938, right?
Yeah, it goes back that far in some places across the country. And what happened was parents and guardians and families of people with disabilities were realizing that the jobless rate for that population was near 100%. There weren't any places that were training and helping people to get into that competitive workplace. They were doing nothing. They were perhaps staying home.
And we're talking about what population? People with disabilities in general, or are we talking cognitive, physical?
Pretty much in general. Now, every facility and every program might work with different populations and specialize. For example, REACH specializes in programs and services for those with the most severe disabilities within our facility-based program. However, again, we do have our supported employment program that since 1987 has placed right around 1,300 people into competitive jobs in the community. So we're very much in tune with that kind of program development and moving forward into the future that Tim's been talking about. For us, it's a great deal of the past. It's 26 years now we've been placing people with disabilities into competitive jobs in the community. And we firmly believe, REACH firmly believes, that those with disabilities that can work in the community should work in the community at competitive jobs. That's what we're all about. But what we're also about is the very important, maybe the most important piece, and that's choice. And choice has been promised to families and people with disabilities through Wisconsin's new family care program. And now we see the possibility of that choice taken away. People like Mort and his daughter Judy don't want their lives legislated. Nobody does. Well, here's another piece of rulemaking coming out of Washington, D.C., that we're nervous about taking away the rights of people to choose where they want to work. And what if they absolutely can't, as Mort described, can't work competitively in the community, even with supports, because the supports are expensive. Nobody's going to fund those at the level they need to be funded. And here's what happens. People with severe disabilities, we get them jobs in the community too, but it might be for 2 hours on Tuesday and 2 hours on Thursday. That's 4 hours a week. People served by REACH are, on average, served 30 hours a week. We're concerned about that sort of takeaway. Again, we have a lot of people at REACH that are on what we call split programs. They might work in the community that 4 to 8 to 12 hours a week, enclaves at Kurt Manufacturing. We clean the Department of Military Affairs. We go out and get contracts in the community as well. But to take away 30 hours worth of quality of life enhancement programs and services for the result of working 2 to 4 to 6 hours in the community, that's a lot of time left over. And that also would be that step backwards to the era that you were talking about, where there were no services going on. Parents and guardians got together and created these services, volunteers first. A lot of church basements were full of programs and services way back then, and they grew into what they are now. But again, I just described some of the evolution that programs and services like REACH has gone through. We're very proud of the 1,300 people that we've placed in competitive jobs in the community. We call that progress. And in terms of not people coming in, I agree with Tim 1,000%. People looked at me strange when I got to REACH in 1987 and said, look, we need a rule that says that nobody automatically comes to REACH. Our referral base was pretty much out of the school system. And what we wanted to make sure is that people were given choices. We had that community, that supported employment program already. It was our first year in 1987, and we wanted to make sure that people coming out of the school systems and, frankly, out of the institutions, is what really fed the REACHs of the world, get an opportunity to function at their highest level, at the most integrated setting appropriate for them. You'll hear me use that phrase. And go on from there. Ideally, they got referred to our supported employment program. They were one of the 1,300. We haven't had a referral at REACH out of the school system. I believe we've had one in the last 3 years. I like that. That means people are going somewhere else rather than staying home. I hope that parents simply aren't being told of their high school graduates, the parents, that there is no funding or we don't refer to community rehab programs anymore. We hope they're given other opportunities, and we hope they're sent to one of ours or somebody else's supported employment program. So there's been a lot of evolution going on, and we're proud to be a part of that.
Well, Tim, I want to ask you, is REACH an isolated case where people are given this choice? And because I've been reading a lot of the complaints or a lot of the concerns about sheltered workplaces, that it's kind of just the last stop for people with certain types of disabilities. Do you think there are situations where they are kind of being funneled in?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. REACH has always been a holistic model, I think, since the very beginning. And I think part of the argument from our point of view is the issue Mort was talking about and Stacey was talking about it in terms of choice. And one of the questions is whose choice?
Right.
Right. It's the system's choice, or the parents' or guardian's choice. What about the individual choice? And exploring all those options as a meaningful way to assess where are we going here, right? And I think we can do that as a team. We can do it as a team of parents and guardians and providers. And so I think, this evolution that's been happening, it's now here, right? You talk about... We don't want people to legislate people's lives. You know, this is not just a state policy issue. Stacey and I sat on a state task force around this very complex policy issue of what does integrated, competitive, community-based employment look like as a policy guidance. Well, it's not only DHS now. It's the Workforce Investment Act. It's VR programs all across the country. It's the Departments of Public Instruction. And now, in the latest iteration, CMS, who's saying, look, you folks have got to begin this process. You know, we sit in this state with a powerful group of community-based rehab programs who have their association that has a strong voice with policymakers. There are states in this country who don't have any types of sub-minimum wage employment anymore, any longer. They've evolved that entire model into a different kind of model. Now, Many have said, people like myself, much as when we had this debate about community transition from skilled nursing facilities or from shutting down the state institutions, we just wanted them shut down. And we'll deal with the people afterwards. Some people in my community, that's true. But that really was not our position. We don't want sheltered workshops shuttered. We're not against facility-based programs. What we're against is doing the kinds of things that happen within those facility-based programs and equating it with work. There's absolutely no reason we cannot develop a system for meaningful programming to happen, for supports to happen, for all of the things that Mort talks about for his daughter that the perception is she benefits from. There's absolutely no reason we cannot build that and make it work for those individuals who truly that is the best outcome for them. It's just our disagreement is how do you fund that? Mm-hmm. How do we evolve it from the system we have today to a system that supports those families and those individuals without getting tied up in this four-letter word, work?
Right. You mentioned choice and the individual choice. Mort, I'm interested in the situations like with your daughter. What if she were given the choice to go out and work at a restaurant or something? Would she be able to make that?
Her reaction would be, what I'm doing is gesturing an I don't know sure. kind of response. In her case, that means she doesn't understand that choice. I'm her guardian, her legal guardian, mm-hmm. and have been since she was 21. I have to make that decision. Does she have a choice? Well, I have always emphasized in the meetings that we have the kind of team meetings that Tim is talking about. Every 6 months, we sit down with providers, we sit down with other parts of the care needs that people with disabilities have. There's about a half a dozen of us on that team. And we work through the program that Judy will have for the next 6 months, including identifying goals and methods for achieving those goals. So we have a lot of that, and the choices come out of that kind of collaboration. And I, as the guardian and her father, have a major voice in what that's going to be. Every one of the 150 severely handicapped people at REACH have that kind of process going on. So the choice is not the agency or the government imposing a choice. The choice is done in collaboration. My daughter's always there, incidentally, mm-hmm. in these meetings. But her cognitive level doesn't allow her to fully understand those kinds of choices. But we have, as Stacy pointed out, had her, she's one of those who's for a couple of hours a week is in a competitive environment. Shredding, which she does, is a fairly automatic process. Well, no human being is going to work at that 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And maintain their sanity in all. But she enjoys that 2 hours a week and is an experience that she gets with it. That works well. As to the threats that are occurring now, we know there are serious efforts, including in Washington, to close center programs. The CMS is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They administer much of the programming and the funding for programs for the disabled. They're part of the Social Security Administration. Medicaid is administered through the Social Security program, and my daughter has been one of the beneficiaries of the supplemental Medicaid funding that's available to help these programs come along. CMS is one of the bodies that is pushing to close centers. We know in New York State that they had literally forced New York State into accepting a phase-out of center-based programs. That sent alarm bells out around the country. They're not moving towards what Tim is suggesting, a model that would be similar to what we do at REACH, but instead CMS is looking to eliminate a sub-minimum wage type of work and eliminate center-based systems. And so that threat is very real because CMS has control of a lot of money.
And with that, we'll talk about the funding in just a bit. We're taking our first break here on the West Side. We're talking about center-based and integrated type employment for people with disabilities. Our guests are Stacy Wigfield. He's the president of REACH. That's the Regional Enterprises for Adults and Children. We've also got Tim Sheehan. He is the executive director for the Center for Independent Living of Western Wisconsin. And Mort Cypress, a concerned parent and chair of the advocacy group, the A-Team. The number to call in, 1-800-228-5615. We've got our first caller on the line. We'll get to them right after the break. This is The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the how to get people with disabilities into the workplace. And there are different schools of thought. There's a lot of changes possibly coming to this whole discussion. We're talking about sheltered workplaces versus non-sheltered and how the federal government may be funding them and the state government as well. The number to call in, 1-800-228-5615. We had a caller, but it turns out it wasn't for the show. So we've got wide open phone lines for people that are interested in this discussion. The number is 1-800-228-5615. The number again, 1-800-228-5615. So as for funding, I'll go to Stacy Wigfield. And as far as funding, Mort was talking about CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. For a person that has the disabilities that would preclude them to working in a sheltered environment, what kind of funding, how is that paid for, Stacy?
Well, the federal government, through Medicaid, makes money available to the states. And in the state of Wisconsin, they've moved to a system called family care. And in the old days, the state gave money to the counties, and places like REACH contracted with the counties across the state to provide these programs. Now, under family care, the money comes to managed care organizations, and places like REACH contract with managed care organizations for funding for programs for people with disabilities that, some people call entitlements. However, in our society, the greatest society on the planet, we know that what we do is take care of those that may not be able to take care of themselves, for example. Hence, funding for people with disabilities that need programs and services to enhance the quality of their life in general. At REACH, that means enhancing their life skills through training with activities of daily living. It might be hygiene. It might be education. It might be some therapies. We're toileting a lot of people that need assistance at some level, sometimes just mild supervision, like getting dressed again. Others, entire assistance to toilet. We help people with feeding issues that might not have the physical skills to feed themselves. We deal with people with overt and challenging behavior issues that might be physically aggressive without some training and behavioral adaptation learning. We tend to be specialists in the area with adults with autism, and again, mostly the severe autistic that have the challenging physical behaviors as well. So these people are funded with those kinds of monies that come through Medicare because they qualify with that severe disability. Part of that money is for the work services that we've been talking about. At REACH, an individual is, in general, we average half work services and half day services. The work services is everything work, and it's real pay for real wages. It's piece rate. It's you're paid by the amount that you can produce. it's sub-minimum wage, therefore. But again, as Mort was talking about, the idea there is that because we can pay, have a sub-minimum wage certificate from the federal government, we can pay you a piece rate to the level that you produce, or you wouldn't have any work at all because you're not at that level where you can work competitively and pay a minimum wage, which is $7.50-some cents an hour. No employer would be able to pay somebody that works at 20%. 100% wages. 80% of our businesses are small businesses. There wouldn't be a lot around if all of their employees worked at 20% and they paid them at 80%. And then the other half of that is the day services that I described, that we're trying to help people learn how to live as independently as possible through training. And some are maintenance because they have a skill level, either cognitively and or physically, where they may or may not improve. Our goal is to get them to improve every day. Some may and some may not.
Now, Tim, real quick, and we do have a caller on the line. We'll get to them right after this. But that you say it's not work. When you're talking about not work, are you talking about the day services, or are you talking about piece rate situations like that, like what Stacy just described?
Well, the piece rate situation that Stacy was just describing is a matter of federal policy. Right.
Right.
It's contained in the Fair Labor Standards Act, where you have this federal exemption.
For now.
For now. Well, it's been around for a long time, right? So we can talk about CMS in asking states to justify how they're going to evolve their community-based rehab facility programs through their state Medicaid plan. And we can talk about the Department of Health Services in the state of Wisconsin wanting to go to a community-based integrated employment system through the managed care organizations, or we can talk about through the Workforce Investment Act VR programs, really actively engaging young people and their families and saying there has to be a series of choices before we end up in an enclave situation. None of that, we can do all of that, but if we don't change the federal Fair Labor Standards Act to actually allow the federal exemption for subminimum wage, everything that we're talking about could still exist. So from our point of view, and this is I think where the rubber really hits the road between advocates on our side and thoughtful people like Stacy and Mort, is we just don't people think individuals ought to engage in what is clearly a productive task under a contract that an organization is getting. They're not, they're getting the value of that contract. And in essence, the work being done to deliver that good or that service is being done by individuals whose wages, in essence, are being subsidized by the staff around them. I mean, that's not technically how it works, but that's the way that it actually practically plays out. We just don't think in the 21st century that that model needs to continue to exist. There has to be a better way, a better way to serve all of the needs of the individuals, the community-based rehab programs at the same time, and the community as a whole, and most importantly, the individuals with significant disabilities who populate those programs.
And let's take our first call. We're going to hear from Don in Eau Claire. Don, you're on the air. Go ahead.
When my father-in-law was 60 years old, he no longer could physically perform the things he'd been doing many years in the private arena.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 5 years of his life, his employer let him cut back to halftime, put him in a job which did not require physical strength or agility, and it worked well. And I think we need to maintain the same sort of flexibility in the areas in which you are dealing with today. And I, for example, when I go grocery shopping, I see a young lady whom I know who she is. She is substantially disabled, but can do a fine job of packaging the groceries and so on. And I don't know how many hours she works. I don't really know her personally. But we need to help these people rise to their highest level. Many of them are much, much happier doing some work, whether it is out in a grocery store or a a food service, something of this sort. For some of them, the choice may have to be something like a sheltered workshop or being taken in a group to go around and do some cleaning or something. But in general, I've made the observation that it is much, much better to keep people busy and happy and socializing. What scares me to some extent is that when people like Mort, as in my age bracket, I think, or close to it, no longer can take charge or be guardians for our kids, we need to provide some continuous public support. But the irony of all this, I think, is that public support is often much cheaper in the long run than sort of trying to gather these people, institutionalize them, and ultimately, as we age, we no longer can do some of these things for our children, whether they're biological or adopted children. And it is cheaper in the long run, more efficient, to actually provide for some of these people and out to the extent of their abilities. And so if the ability is to shred papers, that's fine. If the ability is to go out and do something physical, out to do something which requires dealing more with the public, that's fine too. But this is an instance where the most economical way of treating these people, without taking them out and dumping them on the hillside or something as they age, is to spend a little money and make them as productive as possible. Plus, it's the right thing to do.
All right. Don, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. Anyone else, if they want to get in on the conversation, the number is 1-800-228-5615. Mort, would you like to respond to Don's comment?
One of the realities is that there are different levels of capability among people with disabilities. The young lady that Don is referring to, I think I know who he's talking about, and I know that young lady. She's much higher functioning than Judy is, my daughter.
Sure.
And there's no doubt that this young lady can perform packing bags in a grocery store on the checkout line. If you asked my daughter to do that, you would get that same shrug. She wouldn't know what you're talking about. Mm. She would not know how to do it. I'll give you an example. Several years ago, one of the hotels in town had a contract with supported employment for folding napkins. Mm. Judy was teamed with a blind young man where Judy could do about half the job, and the blind young man could complete the folding process. It took two to produce a napkin.
Hmm.
That was the level of capability that each of them had. After a while, even the hotel decided they couldn't afford, even at the reduced pay that they were paying each individual, and that was discontinued. But it's an example of trying to get someone into a work environment, but finding that they could not individually produce at the level that would justify anywhere near a minimum wage. So that's a reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm concerned, especially with the more severely disabled, and because I see those kinds of jobs being eliminated by the pressures in part coming from CMS in Washington.
We've got another caller on the line, and we go to Amory for this caller. And Dee, you're on the air. Thank you so much for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi. The people have not mentioned a day program that's based in Balsam Lake. It's called the Endeavors Program, and that's also a closed workshop. And they have multi-level groups of people with handicaps in that program.
Okay. Stacy, are you familiar with that?
Yeah, there are several programs like that across the state. And again, going back to what Don said, just about everything Don said there was spot on. And, you know, you talk about the people, as Mort was, about the functioning level. And Tim brought up a great piece about that. I can tell you where REACH stands about minimum wage, and what we don't pay minimum wage because we want to, subminimum wage because we want to. We pay subminimum wage because we have to. That's all that's built into the contract. The level of work, as Mort said, has to be a level that the individuals can do. For example, we do a lot of mailing jobs for Menards, and a lot of what we do is putting a label on a package. That label can be put on that package a lot faster and a lot cheaper by a machine.
Mm-hmm.
So when we bid that job and try to get that really good, clean work from Menards, we have to underbid the machine. You can imagine that therein there is no profit margin left to pay anything more than what we're allowed to pay in that subminimum wage. And again, it's only subminimum wage because the thing about the 14C subminimum wage certificate is that we're allowed to pay people piece rate by the level of their productivity. It doesn't you don't go out there and get that and say it's because we want to pay you little or nothing. It's that we can pay you at all, and that is at the level of your productivity. So if we can get those subcontracts that allow us to provide any work at all for individuals, whether they're in Balsam Lake or Eau Claire or all across the country, that's what we endeavor to do. In the meantime, we hope that people are and we work hard to see, staff works hard to see that people are developing work skills to get them more productive, get them to a level that, where they can work with Judy. Now, Mort mentioned that she functioned with an intellectual level of a five-year-old, yet she's had at least a couple of jobs in the community with supports, and that's what we aim to do, and we hope we get a chance to keep doing it, because if you made, at the federal level, if you made subminimum wage certificates disappear, there would be no work.
Now, we mentioned, Mort mentioned that the situation in New York where the federal government basically forced the closure or encouraged the closure of these sheltered workplaces. And from what I've seen, in February there was a bill introduced in the House of Representatives known as H.R. 838, would discontinue special wage certificates that we're talking about, I believe. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, and it would kind of force a transition. In other words, would end subminimum wage workplaces. If they're a for-profit, it'd be 1 year. Nonprofit, be 3 years. And after 3 years, eventually, it's just gone. What are your thoughts on that? Is that the kind of thing that you're pushing for, that your group is pushing for, Tim Sheehan?
There's a fairly broad support in our community for that type of evolution,
mm-hmm.
whether 1 year or 3 years or 3 years or 5 years or 5 years or 10 years,
right.
is a more practical evolution of the business model, I think is open question with policy. The version of that bill that the Senate passed out of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, the HELP Committee, had a provision in it that talked about a transitional period of time, but also recognized that the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 would actually need to be amended in order for this policy to have effect in all 50 states. And basically what that transition called for is the first step being individuals who are coming out of the K-12 system have the kind of assessment that Stacy was talking about earlier, where there's a whole array of choices talked about, the team meeting that Mort was referencing, and that there was effort and money put forward for those individuals to explore those options before consideration to a facility-based program was allowed. That type of evolution of thinking about how fast can someone grow? What are the skill deficits? What kind of team would need to be put in place in order for this individual to succeed? Is it 3 days a week? Is it 5 days a week? Or is it 1 day a week for 2 hours? And then some time, 5 years seems to me to be a logical time for the programs through the state Medicaid plan to be amended to eventually work to separate the two things as Stacy talked about, which is meaningful day programming, which can involve pre-vocational skill building and all that other stuff, and the work piece. So I don't know if 1 year is reasonable. I don't know if 3 years is reasonable, but I think some evolution is the track we're on, the more I think that the people in the facility-based programming world drag their heels, put their head in the sand, whatever metaphor you want to use here, the more challenging it's going to be to have meaningful outcomes for our friends and neighbors and their families.
We're going to get right back to that in just a bit. We got to take our final break before I forget. This is the West Side. We're talking about the debate over sheltered versus non-sheltered workplaces for people with disabilities. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. We'll be back in 1 minute. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in this Monday morning. We're talking about employment for people with disabilities, and specifically the sheltered workplace versus the non-sheltered workplace, the integrated versus more center-based models. We've got both in the Chippewa Valley in western Wisconsin, and there are some big changes on the horizon possibly for these programs. The federal government is moving towards a more integrated type of system, but some folks, advocates, say that that's not necessarily a good idea for all people. The number to call in, 1-800-228-5615. Before we took the break, we had Tim Sheehan talking about a bill that was introduced into the House of Representatives. It went to the Senate, and there were some changes to it, but basically it would be phasing out these sheltered workplaces over time and figuring out where to draw the line between some pre-vocational versus actual work. Mort, this is obviously a issue of concern for you and your group, the mm-hmm. A-Team.
The way that CMS is trying to administer that direction is what they did in New York State. They gave New York State 3 years to eliminate center-based programs. That's what's frightening. Let me give you an example, a very quick example. A young lady was hired by a firm a number of years ago who was cognitively disabled, could not perform at a very, very high level, but as a favor to the family, the firm hired the young lady, paying her a subminimum wage. Recently, the firm was informed that they could not pay a subminimum wage. And the firm simply said, we can't afford to pay you even the minimum wage and continue on. And so they would have to drop employing that person. That's the reality of the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And if you can't just force people who cannot produce at that kind of level out of work, because that's what that would do.
We've got three callers on the line, and unfortunately we're not going to be able to work through all of them. But first we'll go to Lynn and Eau Claire. Lynn, you're on the air. Thank you so much. We're getting close to the top of the hour, so if you could share with us your thoughts or a question quickly,
sure.
We'd appreciate it. Good morning.
I have a son who is disabled due to a traumatic brain injury. He's totally high functioning. Because of the nature of the injury, he cannot keep a job. I went to the Department of Disability and Aging, talked to someone, and was told specifically that if they helped everyone, our taxes would go up. And specifically, the person I talked to, he didn't want his taxes going up. Hmm. And with our current governor wanting to be able to seize my property when I'm gone, that I can't give it to my son and his daughter, we're in limbo here, and it terrifies me.
All right. Thank you for that, Lynn. And Stacey Wickfield, any thoughts on that?
You know, the only advice I can give is that you keep knocking on those doors and filling out the forms if that's what it takes in terms of eligibility. There are things going on out there about assessments and if they're being done properly and eligibility, if that's being interpreted correctly. Keep knocking on those doors because there's things out there, there's programs and services out there, but you do have to qualify, you do have to fill out the forms, there are assessments, and then you have to be deemed eligible. And keep knocking on that door. I've heard the same kind of stories.
Now, let's just kind of go round robin here because we've only got a few minutes left, but Stacey Wickfield of Reach, I'm wondering, you know, CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, have a lot on their plate right now. What are the odds that anything actually happens by the end of this year? Is there some kind of deadline coming up?
Yeah, we're told that they want to issue the new regulations by the end of this year. And from REACH's point of view, we just don't want to see the baby thrown out with the bathwater here. We like moving forward. We've placed lots of people with disabilities in the jobs in the community. So other states have closed their sheltered workshops, Vermont, Maine, mm-hmm. and Washington, and I encourage people to look up those stats. 36% of the people funded for developmental disabilities in Vermont are working, and they're working at an average of 10 hours a week. In Maine, only 23% of the people have been employed, and they're working for 9 hours a week. So there are the horror stories out there. There is no evidence to show that closing sheltered workshops, and really I'm not sure if it makes a difference when we close them, when we phase them out. There's no evidence to show that that is a better outcome for people than is the opportunities that places like REACH provide.
And Tim Sheehan, very quickly, any thoughts? What's going to happen at the end of this year? Anything?
Well, I think we'll get an extension. And I think it's going to be tied to when state Medicaid plans need to be submitted to CMS, and states are going to be pushed to engage in this evolution.
All right. And Mort Cypress, your thoughts?
That's partially what's scary here in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's contract with CMS is up at the end of this year. And will they push Wisconsin into a system that will put a lot of people out of work, not into work?
We will see. That's our time. Thank you to my guests. Great conversation this hour. Thanks for the people that called in. Stacy Wigfield is the president of REACH. That's Regional Enterprises for Adults and Children. Tim Sheehan is the executive director for the Center for Independent Living in Western Wisconsin. And Mort Cypress is a concerned parent of a child with cognitive disabilities. He is also the chair of the advocacy group titled the A-Team. That's our time. A big thanks to Team Westside, including Dean Collenbeck for handling the phones today. Also, Rachel Minsky and Rachel Vick, as well as Tiffany Coggins. We'll be back next week for a look forward at the politics of the 2014. It's an election year. A lot of stuff coming up, so stay tuned. Until then, stay warm. We'll talk again next Monday morning.